Heather, thank you, and congratulations to the law section for becoming a whole section. I worked for like 25 years trying to get that to happen, and it never did. We always tried to merge with ethics, but ethics wanted nothing to do with law, and that's probably something to be said for that. So my 15 minutes is going to be about two giant topics and trying to see how they relate. So I would, and I look forward to your comments and thoughts as well. This is a work in progress. Obviously, actually both personalized medicine, which is better known as personalized genomic medicine or simply just genomic medicine, and public health and its relationship to the genome are both works in progress. Medicine and public health are often thought to be totally different things. One of the issues in genomics is whether they should merge, at least in this area. But in medicine, we think about the language of bioethics, the doctor-patient relationship, treatment, and autonomy. In public health, you know, this is a general rule. We tend to think about human rights, populations, prevention, and social justice. They're not necessarily inconsistent. I think they can both live quite well together, but they can often be in tension as well. No one really knows what personalized medicine is going to look like. All we know is that it has something to do with sequencing the genome and finding various sequences or mutations that have health implications, either as to what drug is likely to metabolize better or worse for the person, what diseases you are likely or predisposed to get, and therefore what interventions might help you either prevent those diseases or, if you already have them, to cure those diseases. Very exciting. There are a couple of celebrity examples I'll use just to run through. You probably all recognize Sergey Brin and his wife, the founder of 23andMe. Sergey, who also founded Google, obviously, is used 23andMe to locate, to do his genome, and he found he had the LRRK2 mutation, which predisposed him to Parkinson's, a disease that his mother also had. So you could have done that by family history, I guess. And the data is not that great, but it raises your risk of Parkinson's between 30 and 75%. So Sergey is a real hands-on guy, so he read all the literature and found out that you could reduce your risk by exercise, caffeine intake or coffee drinking, and smoking. He said he didn't want to do the smoking, but he did do a whole exercise routine, and he does drink coffee now. And he calculated that that reduced his risk to about 25%. And then he also added to that, he contributed like $70 million to Parkinson's research, and other people have done that as well. So he thought that scientists' medicine will be advanced by the time he gets Parkinson's disease, so that cut his risk down to, he thought, about 13%. So that's pretty interesting. Not everybody could do that, obviously. Steve Jobs, who, pretty famous story, had first treated his pancreatic cancer with herbs and diet and things that lots of people like, didn't help. He finally went to medicine, tried everything, and wound up in the last year of his life having his entire genome sequenced and the pancreatic tumor sequenced as well in a quest to try to find a cure. He said he thought he'd either be the last person to die or the first person to be cured with genomic medicine. Neither was quite right, but Ralph Steinman, you may know, is the winner of last year's Nobel Prize in Medicine. Ralph also had pancreatic cancer. He won the Nobel Prize for his work in dendrites and trying to find a vaccine for cancer. In the last 4.5 years of his life, he was the subject of 8 different experiments, all of them which could be called, were personalized to him. He was the sole participant in each of those experiments. And his treatment in the last 4.5 years of his life was described as the most personalized medical treatment ever given to a human being. I like Ralph's story for lots of reasons, but the main reason is you may remember that he was dead when he was awarded the Nobel Prize. And the committee didn't know what to do about that. They hadn't realized he was dead. They gave him the prize they voted on Friday, and by the time he was tried to be notified, it was found he was dead. The reason I like this story is it took a lawyer to resolve this. The committee went to the lawyers, and the lawyers said, no, the intent was that you don't vote for a dead person, but if you didn't know the person was dead, it was okay to vote for him. So the committee was very relieved, and they awarded the Nobel Prize to Ralph. The final personalized medicine story is Christopher Hitchens, famous atheist, famous writer as well, who spent the last year of his life, and he wrote about this in his last book published after he died, Mortality, going through just about every possible treatment you could think of. His friend, and he actually is his friend, Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project and now the head of NIH, helped coach him to find various treatments at NIH, various experiments, and ultimately he had also his entire genome and his esophageal cancer tumor sequenced. It didn't help, but he tried everything, and he wanted to try everything. And these examples of celebrity medicine are given just for a couple of reasons. One, these are people who have access to every possible counseling and anything that's out there. And they take it, which is pretty interesting, all right? I mean, would we? I don't know. But the other thing we know about this, if we all did, medicine would become impossible. It's burdensomely expensive now, but it would be ridiculously. It would be impossible. You just couldn't make this available to everyone. So one of the questions that raises, should just celebrities get this? Should just very rich people get to do genomic medicine? Or should we try to make it cheaper so everybody can get access to it? President's Bioethics Panel, as many of you know, just last week released their study on human genomics and the privacy of the human genome. And what they essentially, cut to the bottom line, what they essentially said is they think that the genomics revolution is so important that everybody should be involved with it. We should all donate our DNA to major banks around the world, around the country, so that we can be studied. On the other hand, they said people won't do it, and people shouldn't be expected to do it unless their privacy is protected. So we need, I think we need more than they say, but we need much, much stronger privacy protection for genomics, because all these things we just found out, that your gene can predispose you to various conditions, can tell which treatments might be better, and that information may be good for you to know, but it may be harmful. Other people may discriminate against you and use it against you in different settings. If you want to collect this information, collect DNA samples, which have been blood samples primarily, my colleagues and I have suggested in the past that you have to look at four distinct actions, which are collection, analysis, storage, and disclosure. And each one has its own legal dimensions. One of the more important issues in privacy is that genetics implicates three major types of privacy: informational privacy, decision-making privacy, and relational privacy, because your genome is shared with your siblings and your parents and your children. All right? And we've seen in the past many, many ideas of many, many problems with discrimination. We don't have to go through those again. You all know that. And with privacy, my favorite metaphor, since it's my metaphor, is to look at your genome as your future diary. It's coded and probabilistic. I'm not a determinist, but it does tell you things that are likely to happen to you in the future if you don't get run over by a bus. Big debates about what we should look at genetic sequencing information as. Is it property? Or is it something else? Is it just information that's not property? My own view is we should look at it as property, but you don't have to do that. We bank it. I think we're using the wrong metaphor for banking, the biobanks, because you don't put it in and take it out yourself. You put it in, other people take it out. So maybe it's a warehouse. I'm actually not sure what it is. Maybe it's like a library. Library maybe close to it, because other people take it out then, right, and use it and then put it back in again. Once it's digitalized, you don't have to ever put it back in. Everybody can have its own copy. But the question is, how is it possible, or is it possible, for individuals to have any control over their information once it's in one of these giant libraries or biobanks? And we know people do want control over it. We know people get very upset when other people use their genomes, or the genomes of their, in this case, the Havasupai tribe, to rewrite their own history or to identify genetic mutations that may implicate the entire tribe. This is a best-selling book. I'm sure many of you have read it, if not all of you. It's been a bestseller for 4 years. Who could possibly believe the story of Henrietta Lacks would be a best-selling book? But it is. It's even stressed out some scientists and ethicists who wrote that you shouldn't take this book seriously, that this book implies that people actually own their own tissue samples and that people shouldn't take them without their permission. And an article in Science, they were horrified at this because scientists should own this stuff. Because progress is important, and we can't make progress without doing it. Obviously, that goes too far. I mean, even the writers said, of course, we should get informed consent. But the fact that they didn't get informed consent in Henrietta's case did not bother them at all. They said we really don't owe anything to Henrietta's family. That seems to me to be a little bit extreme. The case, and they cite the case over and over again. We're lawyers here, lots of us are anyway, so we know the case, the John Moore case, where the court, California Supreme Court, argued absolutely unpersuasively, and in a case that's really, you know, makes no sense at all, that everybody in the world can own your DNA and your cells, except you. Either nobody can own it, or everybody can own it. But the idea that only you're the only one who can't own it is ridiculous. In her book, in the opening sheet, she has a little quotation, and it's from Elie Wiesel, and so I think it's worth noting. And this is essentially what the book is about. Elie Wiesel writes that we must not see any person as an abstraction. Instead, we must see in every person a universe with its own secrets, its own resources, treasures, its own sources of anguish, and with some measure of triumph. He put it very poetically, to put it simply, we're all our own people. We're all individuals, and to try to treat us as some kind of national resource that's available for research without consent, without privacy, without taking into account the individual lives of individual people, it's just not right. What we have are not, it's not that the genome's exceptional, it's that people are exceptional, and people can't be used without their permission. My friend and colleague, the late Jonathan Mann, used to say, and he was clearly right about this, that the determinants of health are social. Of course, that's kind of public health credo. But what he meant by that also is that if you really want to change health and improve health, you have to change the society. You have to change the underlying determinants of health. You have to improve education, nutrition, all the things public health people are very cognizant of. The health and human rights movement, which he founded, is based on universality, human dignity, includes the right to health. But non-discrimination is the critical issue there. Today there seems to be some debate about which framework to use, whether you use a health and human rights framework, whether you use social justice, bioethics. I think they can all work together. I really, really do. And I think it's a waste of time for us to argue which framework is better. That they all have their proper place. I think that gift giving is the right metaphor for giving tissues to biobanks. You give a gift, you can condition gifts, and you should put whatever conditions you want on there. And I'll end with on this note on personalized medicine with Francis Collins, again, the head of NIH and the head of the Genome Project, just said this in an interview a couple weeks ago. He said that he thinks there's going to be a new discipline of preventional health. It will be run by a preventionalist. And he thinks they're going to be the frontline physicians for most people. And their job is to help you stay healthy before disease strikes. Now, one might think that's a public health dream. I might also think it's a public health nightmare. It would make more sense to me, maybe nothing to you, that instead of having a new physician who just does public health, that all physicians do public health, and that we don't have to choose between going to the doctor when we're sick or going to and having good prevention discussions while we're still well. As a sidelight, we said at the beginning, I'll end with this too, that it's clear now, there are some things that medicine does that are just too expensive. We have no rules, no way we can figure out how to do rationing. Rationing is a bad word. You can't use it in policymaking, but we have to. it's time to have a new language. We can call it something else if you want. I think we just call it rationing and decide when it's the new drug is too expensive. There's been good discussions out, even in the New York Times in the last couple of weeks, that the new cancer drugs, which do the same thing as the old cancer drugs but cost twice as much, shouldn't be used. Sloan Kettering doctors said that. Just don't use them. It's just ridiculous. And I'll end with my favorite piece of art, which is Damien Hirst's diamond-crusted skull. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this. It's called For the Love of God, and he says it's called that because his mother said to him after he did it, "Damien, for the love of God, what are you going to do next?" And, well, that's our question. What are we going to do next? All right? Are we going to try every time someone dies to set up, as my friend Dan Callahan said, a new institute of health to try to prevent that type of death? Or at some point, are we going to recognize that death is inevitable and we'll just do the best we can to keep ourselves as healthy as long as we can and then not oppose death too strongly when opposition is impossible? Thank you very much.